Or is it just the case that one or two particularly bright or able ones who pick up on it get there first, whilst the other kids are like, well, I haven't discovered anything?
It's Math Talk Across the Pond with teacher, podcaster, and creator of DiagnosticQuestions.com. You'll find out soon. Stick with us.
And now, it's time for another edulicious episode of the Bentley Brothers Podcast, bringing you what's current and what works in education. Here are your hosts, Scott and Tim Bentley.
Bentley Brothers, Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bentley Brothers, yep. Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Yep. First name Bentley, last name Brothers.
Yes, Scott, we are so thrilled to be talking to a fellow English speaker and Englishman, actually, which we are not.
I was told we needed a translator for today. I don't know.
We're the rebels, right? The colonists. Is that what you call us, Scott? We're the colonists.
We are the colonists.
Yes. We're talking to Craig Barton today. And I want to tell you a little bit about Craig because Scott and I are both big fans of Craig. And perhaps some of you might not know who he is, but we really want you to know who he is. And so that's why we're having him on the show today. Craig has been a maths teacher for, and I'm going to say maths out of respect for Craig as much as I possibly can. Craig has been a maths teacher for the last 11 years, working at Range High School in Formby and Thornlie Salesian College in Bolton. Did I say that right, Craig?
That's a good effort. Salesian. No, that's close enough. That's good, though.
Okay. For the last 6 years, he has been the secondary maths advisor to TES, formerly the Times Education Supplement, the largest professional network of teachers in the world. Craig is the co-creator of Diagnostic Questions. This is a free website that helps teachers and students all around the world identify, understand, and resolve key misconceptions. Mr. Barton regularly runs workshops, delivers keynote addresses, and works with maths departments both in the UK and overseas. And most of all, Craig is the host of one of Scott and my favorite podcasts, Mr. Barton's Maths Podcast, where he interviews great educational leaders like Daisy Christodoulou, Greg Ashman, and the incomparable Dylan Williams. So welcome to the show, Craig.
Oh, thank you very much, Tim and Scott. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so if nothing else, we're going to add to the cool factor of our show because of your accent there. We love it.
Yeah, I only put it on for the show.
Oh, okay.
We appreciate it.
So one of the things that attracted me to your show, well, your podcast is not truly about maths, in my opinion. It's really about good teaching and what that means and what that looks like. And so Scott and I don't know if Scott will agree with me, but we tend to kind of gravitate towards the constructivist, student-centered approach to teaching. And there's a big echo chamber happening in the United States with that, especially with Common Core. So I'm just excited to talk to you because your podcast presents a different take on what good teaching is for the most part, and that is more of explicit instruction. So can you go ahead and explain to our listeners kind of where you're coming from first in terms of what good teaching looks like?
Of course. Well, it's an interesting one, really, because, and it may surprise you, this, Tim, but I was probably, without knowing it, a constructivist myself for the first maybe 10 years. And all I'd heard throughout my teacher training was that the teacher shouldn't speak very much. It's all about student discovery. It's all about teaching through projects. It's all about puzzles, rich tasks. And whenever I was observed, one of the criticisms that was always made of my teaching was that I spoke too much. And something inside just felt, didn't feel quite right about this. And then when I started my podcast, probably 2 years ago now, and I started to speak to people like Dylan William and Greg Ashman and so on, and they prompted me to start doing a bit of reading of research and start kind of questioning what I was doing and what I've been doing for the last 12 years. And when I start, and this is, we may fall out before we've even got going here, but when I started doing all the reading, I really struggled to find evidence for project-based learning, inquiry-based learning, teaching problem solving as a generic skill and so on. All the evidence seems to suggest that explicit instruction, an expert teacher explaining things really carefully, giving students good examples, plenty of time to practice, was the way forward. And as such, I've kind of really transformed my way of teaching. And people seem to think that kind of direct instruction is boring and it's lecturing and so on. It's nothing like that at all. And it's, I don't think I've ever taught better. I don't think my kids have ever enjoyed maths more, and I don't think they've ever learned more. So I'm swayed, and I'm happy to kind of engage in any kind of argument on this, because yeah, I'm direct instruction all the way now.
Hey, Craig, can you give us a look at what that looks like in your definition of direct instruction? Because people will probably have different conceptions about that.
Sure, yeah. And to be honest with you, like, it's funny you said at the start, and I was talking to Tim before we went on air, this is my 12th year of teaching now, and the more I read and the more I speak to people, the less I understand. And it's the classic Dunning-Kruger effect that, if you don't know much, you think you're an expert. And the more you start reading, you realize you don't have a flipping clue what's going on. So I'm speaking here as if I know what I'm talking about, but I don't really. But this is my opinion. So,
I think we can agree that we all know what we're talking about as much as experience.
Sure, perfect. We're in good company. Perfect.
Yeah, I am totally on there with you.
Okay. Fantastic. So for me, direct instruction, it's kind of possibly seen as traditional teaching, but I take a lot from cognitive load theory, and I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the work of John Sweller, but I'm an absolute I love him. I've never met him, but I'm in love with him already. So it's all about making the key part of learning as accessible to kids as possible, and withdrawing all the stuff that just gets in the way of learning. So it's all about giving crystal clear instructions. A massive part of it is worked examples. That is a huge, huge part of direct instruction. So it's me as a teacher giving a crystal clear explanation, but then being so careful with the examples I choose. And I'm a big fan of example pairs. So I will, on the left-hand side of my board, I will do a worked example. The kids won't be saying a word. Maybe I'll be questioning them at certain points, but it'll be very clear to them that they are following me and listening to me. Then on the right-hand side of the board, there will be an equivalent problem that they will then have a go at. And this has been a big transformation for what I used to do, because even when I did worked examples before, the mistake I would make is I would do 3 or 4 different worked examples, and then I'd say to the kids, so that'd be the first 15 minutes of the lesson, and then I'd say to the kids, right, off you go, now you work your way through 20 questions. And the problem there was, of course, by the time the kids had seen 4 worked examples, they couldn't flip in and remember what the first worked example was. So they get stuck on question one, and I'd end up having to go through it again. So what I do now is I do an example, they try one, they practice. Stop that. Then I do an example, they do one exactly the same, then we practice. And it's this repetition, this me modeling, me not being afraid to speak, me not being afraid to question them and so on, but also not giving them too much free rein, and realizing that, and it sounds very arrogant saying this, but realizing that I am the expert in the room. I've spent hours planning this lesson. I've chosen my examples carefully. I want to direct their learning because I think I know the best way to convey this concept, as opposed to giving them free rein, hoping they discover something that's vaguely right and figuring it out for themselves. So that's my direct instruction. Very much teacher focused and example focused.
So some people say that when kids discover something on their own, that it sticks more, that it's a deeper, more meaningful learning. And I know that you don't agree with that. So can you explain to our listeners why that's not true?
By the way, I'm just going to say this really fast. There's people throwing their phones out their car windows right now.
Nice. My visa to the US has been rescinded before I've applied for it here. But yeah. And I should say, with all this, I used to believe this. This is the thing. And I'll also, a little disclaimer, I'm not 100% on this new way I'm approaching things. But I'm coming at this from a convert. So I used to believe that discovery was the best way to do things. But the problem is, how often do kids discover the right thing? So there's two things I'd say. Firstly, how often do they actually discover what you want them to discover? And how often do they discover something that's almost there, but then you end up having to re-explain it and put it in your own words? How many times do all the kids discover it? Or is it just the case that one or two particularly bright or able ones who pick up on it get there first, whilst the other kids are like, oh, I haven't discovered anything? And secondly, and this is my big one, this is the real big one, and this is whenever I'm planning lessons and I'm thinking of activities, I always ask myself this: what is the opportunity cost of the activity I'm doing? So let me give you a little example. Say, do you have, and forgive me if there's a kind of translation issue. Do you have kind of circle theorem, circle geometry, where you've got like angles in circles and angle rules and all that kind of thing, like angles at the center, alternate segment theorem. You have things like this, but perfect. Yeah. So I used to, whenever I was teaching any kind of angle facts, but particularly circle theorems, I would want students to discover them for themselves. So what I would traditionally do is I would give out a load of blank circles, arm them with rulers, angle measurers, compasses, whatever they want, and I'll give them some instructions to say, construct this, measure this, write down what you notice. Construct this, measure this, write down what you notice. Share it with your partner, do it in a group, blah, 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 blah. 2 hours later, everyone's knackered, everyone's out of breath, there's compasses, rulers flying everywhere, and if I'm lucky, kids have discovered 2 or 3 of these angle facts. But more often than not, what's happened is kids have mismeasured angles. They've discovered things that weren't even there. They've got new misconceptions and so on. And when I go back to opportunity cost, so what was the cost of me doing that activity? Well, the opportunity cost was what I could have been doing instead of doing that. So what I could have been doing is I could have told them within 10 minutes all the circle theorems and spent 1 hour, 50 minutes practice, practice, practice until their knowledge was incredibly secure, they were fluent at the skills, and they were feeling confident. Instead, what I did is I spent 2 hours letting them try and discover something that half of them never discovered at the end anyway. And at the end, they all feel confused and I end up having to re-explain it. But it's even worse than that. I'm sorry, I'm getting off on one here, but I'm just going to finish this off. It's not even as if 2 hours later, I'm back at square one where I can just explain it to them, because I'm not. Because some of them, the kids, are now confused that they're not as receptive to learning as they would have been had they never even heard of a circle theorem to begin with. So not only do I lose 2 hours, I also then am trying to backtrack, trying to say, oh no, forget all that stuff that you're confused about. It's actually really easy. Here's how you do it. So in the end, I've just cut out the middleman. I just explain it really well first and give them plenty of time to practice. And that's why I don't believe there's any point in letting kids discover things.
Do you want kids to understand math conceptually?
Yeah, right. Okay, so it's all kicking off now. I definitely do.
Okay.
But I would argue for kids to understand things conceptually, they've got to have the knowledge first. And this has been a big, big breakthrough for me. And I've only come to this realization maybe 2 months ago. And you're going to hate me for saying this. And I tell you what, if listeners haven't switched off already, they're going now when I say this next thing. I reckon, and I almost hate myself for saying this. I reckon that sometimes, and by sometimes, I mean actually quite often, it's important to teach the how first and the why second. So it's important to teach kids how to do something, so get the skills there, and then return to the why later. And my argument for that would be, if you try and teach the why first, so why do angles on a straight line add up to 180 degrees? Here's a classic one. Why, when we're dividing fractions, do we flip the second fraction over and change the divide to multiply? If you start with the why, the kids don't have the knowledge to interpret or understand the why. It's better to start with the how. Tell them how to do something, get them comfortable doing something, get them enjoying the topic, and then say, right, I wonder why that method works. Let's go and investigate that. As opposed to starting with the why first, they get confused with the why, they then don't want to do the how, and once again, you're backtracking. So I do want them to have conceptual understanding, but I would argue that it can come later in the process.
Hey, Craig, I know people are asking this. We've done the pendulum swing over here in the United States, and this is my 23rd year in education. We've gone back and forth. Is there not a balance between this? Is there not something that's kind of finding the discovery, but also giving the, you know, explicit instruction?
I think there is. Yeah, I think there is. And I'm kind of choosing extreme examples. There's a couple of things I'd say. The first is, for something like algebra, I think you've got to be very careful. With algebra, it's very important that kids have a deep conceptual understanding. So that will be something. I would still take control. I would still not let them discover things, because I want to be very careful with algebra, that their algebraic understanding and the fundamentals are in place. So algebra, I really need them to have conceptual understanding. But for that very reason, I'm going to take even more control over their learning there. But I'll tell you one thing I do like, and that's kind of, this is a rubbish phrase for it, but I'm going to call it pattern sniffing, or which sounds a bit dodgy, or kind of pattern identifying. And that's where, take something like, now this will test my kind of translation issues. We call them the rules of indices. Do you call them exponents or something? You know, powers, like 2 to the power of minus 2. Have I got that lingo right? Okay, perfect. Yeah, that's a good start. So say I was doing, I want kids to know, what is 3 to the power of -2? Now, I could just tell them, I could just say, if you say see 3 to the power of -2, you just write that as 1/3 squared, and that's 1/9. Now, that's okay. I could tell them that. Or I could let them see if they can sniff out the pattern. And what I mean by that is, I'll give them a calculator, and I'll say, work out 3 to the power of -2, work out 5 to the power of -2, work out 7 to the power of -2, bang it in your calculator, see what you get. What's the rule? What's the pattern? Now, that is almost a little bit of discovery, but crucially, it's not some kind of proof. I'm still structuring it, but it's a way for them to start to see the rules. But even as I'm saying this, I would still argue that there is still nothing wrong with me saying, if something's to the power of -2, it's just 1/(that)² and then use the extra time to get them practicing it. Because here's the big thing, and I'm sorry, I know I'm kind of ranting and raving here, but this will be, I'm going to shut up.
That's why we have you on the show.
This is why my shows are 3 hours long, because I just can't keep quiet. And this is the last thing I'll say on this. Here's the big thing, right? I used to think, for kids to be motivated, for kids to enjoy maths, they had to discover maths, it had to be real life, it had to be project-based, all this. Load of rubbish. There is one thing and one thing only that makes kids enjoy mathematics, and that is their belief of how good they are at maths, their self-efficacy. There has been countless studies. I've got them all cited on my website. For kids to be motivated, they need to have a good belief in their ability in mathematics. How do you give them that belief? Do you just let them off the leash in the vague hope that they'll discover something? Or do you teach them something really well, get them practicing it, get them confident, and get them going away saying, I understood that, I'm good at mathematics? I would argue that explicit instruction lends itself more to the latter of those approaches.
I just want to talk about the pattern sniffing. I love that term. So let me tell you, I'm gonna be like, leave myself wide open here.
You better copyright that too, really fast here.
Yeah, really. Pattern sniffing.
Somebody just grabbed the URL.
Patternsniffing.com. So Craig, I'm gonna leave myself wide open. You can just tell me what's wrong with what. I teach my kids how to divide a whole number by a fraction through pattern sniffing.
Okay.
So I present to them, and is it discovery? Yes, it's guided discovery. It's not throw the stuff out there and give them some open-ended problem and hope that they discover some math along the way. It's like basically pretty similar to what you described. And so I'm saying, what's 12 divided by 12? And so they all know it's 1, right? Okay. 12 divided by 12 is 1. 12 divided by 6 is 2. 12 divided by 4 is 3. 12 divided by 3 is 4. 12 divided by 2 is 6. 12 divided by 1 is 12. And then I throw in, I say, then what's 12 divided by 1/2?
Yep.
And invariably, the kids come up with 6 as the answer. And then some of them see the pattern, and I set them off debating with each other over what the answer is. And what I experience is all around the room, first of all, my kids are totally into it. I mean, they do have this efficacy because I've trained them to argue their point and to, and to defend what they believe is to be true. And also to be flexible to understand that you could be wrong. People need to understand that as well. I mean, you and I mean, that's what happened to you, right? I mean, you realize, hey, I'm wrong on this, and I need to be hold this loosely because I could be wrong. And so inevitably what I hear all over the room is, oh, yeah. And then I'm the last resort for feedback in the room. And at the end, I'm like, okay, let's talk about this. I might have a kid come up, explain their thinking on it. I explain it. And I found that that one lesson, and bam, I'm done with that concept because it sticks in their mind so well. I've done the same thing with volume. I've done the same thing with different like pattern sniffings, but it's always just one little step above what they're able to do. If I'm going to introduce something that's completely foreign to them, I'm not going to like just say, here, let's discover this. But if it's just one little step up, and let me give you one last thing, another example. I went into, my son teaches math as well. He teaches high school math. Scott and I both teach fifth grade. I went into his classroom and watched him teach one day. And he had a girl in his room who was a freshman in high school, I think, or maybe a sophomore. And she was confounded when she did not, she had A over A as a fraction, and she could not understand how that could be one.
All right.
And so I'm thinking like she needed the foundation when she was younger to truly understand the concept that that's a division problem. If you're doing any number divided by itself, you get one.
Yes.
So anyway, now tell me what I'm doing wrong. I'm totally open to that.
Yeah. So firstly, I mean, look, I'm no expert in the slightest. And the second thing I'll say, the little disclaimer before I go off on one again here, is 12 months ago, I would have taught that lesson exactly the same. And I would have been, I'm talking here about the divided whole number by fractions lesson.
Right.
I would have taught that lesson exactly the same. And I would have been very happy with myself. And still, if I was planning that lesson tonight to teach on Monday to my year nines or whatever, I would be very, very tempted to do the same lesson. I think it's an absolutely great lesson. And I think it can work very well. But to play devil's advocate, let me just ask you a couple of things here, Tim. Right.
Okay. Good.
So first, how long from starting off on the activity to you providing the final explanation for how to, what the actual correct method was? So how long from you setting the kids off, they've had the discussion, you've got kids debating, you've got kids up at the front sharing the method, you've then come in and kind of summarized everything. That, how long from start to finish would you say?
Oh, 45 minutes, maybe something like that.
45. So my first kind of thing that I would say is, and again, I'm playing devil's advocate here. I'm not saying I fully believe in this, but how can you counter the argument that you could have done that explanation crystal clear yourself in 5 minutes? The kids could have had 40 minutes or even 30 minutes of solid practice, use the last 5 or 10 minutes or whatever for either a discussion or for some applications of that problem, maybe moving into some algebraic variants or something like that. I think the kids would have learned more with a clearer explanation at the start, followed by some well-designed practice. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is this, and I think you hit the nail on the head. You said kids were having great discussions and kids were willing to be wrong, willing to be right, and so on. And I think that's absolutely superb. But answer me this, Tim, which teaching model is more likely to lead to kids having misconceptions? Is it the one where you provide a crystal clear explanation, the kids practice, you assess their practice, and they've had 40 minutes of practice for you to assess, or you let kids give them the freedom to talk to each other, suggest alternate theories, oh, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, or blah, 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 blah. Again, I would argue it's the latter. If you're looking to avoid kids developing misconceptions, again, I think I'd argue the teacher needs to take a little bit more control. But I'm saying that as somebody who's a convert, and I still use pattern sniffing. I still use pattern sniffing, but I'm just questioning. I'm always now questioning, what's the opportunity cost of that? Yeah. And I always ask myself that. If I'm not doing pattern sniffing, what else could I be doing? And is what else I could be doing better for long-term learning of my students? And that's always what I'm questioning myself at the moment.
Well, and let me respond to that. So my feeling on it at this point in time, but this can change because I might be like you, and in a year from now, I might be.
Sure.
First of all, I taught direct instruction, explicit instruction for years and years and years. So I saw what happened with the kids in that explicit instruction model, and I like my kids better when I put them out there. To me, my top priority, believe it or not, is not math, it's character. And so I develop students that have tenacity, perseverance, verbal skills, that they can discuss things intelligently with someone else and expouse their, give their theory on something and back it up with evidence. And so I see the character development in that model to be so much stronger. The other thing is that I can't tell you how many times when I taught the explicit instruction way of things, I would come back to it a couple months later, because really when you're doing that explicit instruction and tons of practice on one thing, it's hard to squeeze in that spiral review. And so I would come back to it 2 months later and my kids would have no clue how to do it. It was like we were starting on square one. So
why is it why is it harder to fit in the spiral review? Surely you're saving yourself more time. I mean, you spent 45 minutes on that lesson. Right. I could do it in, say, 20 minutes, and I could use the remaining 20 minutes to practice something from the week before and the week before that. Direct instruction saving time, surely. And in that time you're saving, you can do the interleaving, you can do the space learning. Surely discovery is taking more time and leaving you less time to review those concepts.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Hey, Craig, I do want to ask a question, because teaching different levels, different age groups of kids, we have to factor that piece into all this discussion, right? So maybe there is a place for, and you can talk about the research that you've read and the people you've talked to, but maybe there is a place for a little bit of a mix of both at different age levels, and that explicit instruction is really more important at the higher levels than it is at the lower levels. Like as a whole or no?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. My instinct, and again, you've got to understand, Tim and Scott, I hate myself at the moment, right? Because I used to think I was
starting to hate myself too.
Yeah, it's bad, right? Because the thing is, the lessons
my sunk cost, Craig, my sunk cost in this is tremendous.
Yeah. But like the lessons where I set the kids off, I spoke for 2 minutes at the start, I set the kids off doing an activity, then we all came back together at the end and discussed it. I used to flipping love those lessons. And the kids did enjoy them. There's no doubt about that. But so often at the end of those lessons, I just found myself having to essentially do teaching, essentially say, all right, you've said this. I kind of know what you mean. All right, here's actually what you mean. And I just end up explaining it anyway. So when you say about the balance, there definitely is a balance. And look, I think a lot of people think explicit instruction and direct instruction is just a teacher speaking for an hour, kids not saying a word, bored out of the mind, they've no way to connect it, it doesn't mean anything to them, all that kind of stuff. No, not at all. Explicit instruction, direct instruction is an interactive process. It's got to be crucially tied with formative assessment. As a teacher, I'm saying things and I'm assessing. Have you understood what I mean? I'm obsessed with diagnostic questions, multiple choice questions. I need to know kids' specific misconceptions. I could speak for 10 hours on this, so I won't go down that line. But to address your point, Scott, I'm going to argue that to have that discovery, to have that independence, to have that ability to make connections and so on, you need the knowledge first. Who's more likely to have that background knowledge? The older kids. So I'm going to argue that explicit instruction and direct instruction, whatever you want to call it, is probably more appropriate for younger, less academically achieving students than it is for the older ones. The older ones, the evidence suggests that problem solving then becomes an effective strategy for learning. Let kids problem solve. You have a thing in cognitive load theory called the expertise reversal effect, where worked examples stop becoming effective once kids have a certain level of knowledge. But before that, it should all be worked examples and direct instructions. You let kids loose with no knowledge, God knows what's going to happen. And you're going to end up trying to pick up the pieces afterwards. So I'm arguing the younger kids, direct instruction all the way.
Wow. Craig, I could like talk to you. We might just like stop the broadcast and we could just talk the rest of the day.
Sure, I don't know if anyone's still listening, but
Oh my gosh. I just love it because it just gets me thinking. I'm just like, I'm doing right now what I ask my kids to do all the time in the classroom, which is to defend, you know, sure, and to give evidence and really think about where they're coming from. So,
and Craig's giving you explicit instructions on how it works.
Exactly.
That is it.
It's been fantastic, Craig. What an awesome discussion. We really appreciate the time. And Tim?
Yeah, we're gonna lighten things up now and just play a little game with you.
Okay. Cool.
So, Craig, besides changing the world through your podcast, you're an aspiring author. Our listeners probably don't know that. You've written 3 novels, and today we're going to ask you 3 questions that all relate to your books. We're calling this little game J.K. Rowling isn't the only prolific author from the UK.
I like it.
That's the name of the game. That's a long name, isn't it? So, Scott, why don't you tell our audience who Craig will be competing for today?
Craig, you're going to be competing for Chris Anderson, a fourth grade teacher in Norfolk, Nebraska. If you're that's in the center of the U.S. there. If you're able to answer 2 out of 3 questions correctly, Chris will be awarded a free download of an album of the ridiculously popular constructive music. Just kidding. Oh, gosh, man. Rocking the standards, Tim.
All right, Craig. Oh, man. Flipping.
The stakes are high. I'm nervous here.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. So, Craig, here we go with question number one. One of your novels is called Secrets and Mince Pies.
Yes.
It's easy to write mince pies in the title of the book, but do you know which of these three is not true of mince pies? So we're going to give you three things, and you have to sniff out the nice. Incorrect one about mince pies, all right? And mince pies are popular in the UK, huh?
They are. I'm just thinking it'd be more efficient if you could just directly instruct me what the right answer is here. But I'll go for it. I'll play along.
We want you to discover the truth here. All right.
Sure.
So is it answer A, Scott?
Mince pies weren't always called mince pies. Previously, names included shred pies, Christmas pies, crib cakes, and mutton pies. They were even called wayfarer's pies at one time, and they were given to visitors during Christmas season.
Okay.
Or is it B?
Mince pies are not actually British. While mince pies have been widely accepted as a British tradition, the idea actually started in the Middle East in the 13th century. European crusaders returned with the homelands and brought recipes including meats, fruits, and spices, which inspired the notion for a mince pie.
Okay.
Or is it C?
Mince pies are symbolic. The cinnamon, cloves, and nutmeg ingredients were included to represent threefold parts of a man, body, soul, and spirit.
All right. So you have three answers. Then you have to sniff out the incorrect one. Mince pies have had several other names. The second choice is that they're not actually British, or they're symbolic of the threefold parts of man.
Ooh, difficult. Well, it may surprise you this, but I actually hate mince pies. I think they're the worst part of Christmas. So I'd like to disown them and claim they're not British, but I'm going to go for answer C is the false one, I think.
And answer C it is. That's correct. Or should I say incorrect?
Nice. Nice. Good. All right. Good stuff.
So mince pies are symbolic. But the truth is that they're actually the ingredients represent the gifts given to the baby Jesus by the three Eastern kings.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Good fact.
Yeah. Not body, soul, and spirit. So
nice.
Thought we might be able to trick you on that one, but I guess not. Okay. Question number two. Another of your novels entitled Tell Me a Story tells of two 19-year-olds who rob a supermarket. Though we haven't actually read your book, I'm sorry to say, Craig, on
not many yet. Don't worry about it.
We are pretty sure that these young men didn't pull off the robbery the way that one man in Philadelphia did. How did this odd robber use some groceries to get cash and cigarettes from the cashier? Is it A?
He stuck a banana in his pocket to fool the cashier into thinking he was brandishing a gun.
Or is it B?
He threw an open bag of flour at the cashier's face to blind her.
Or is it C?
He bashed the cashier in the head with a melon, knocking him out cold.
God. So
you should know this, right?
Strange Philadelphia robber either had a banana in his pocket, he threw an open bag.
God. It's taking a turn for the worse. Yeah.
We're going to lose our rating on iTunes.
Oh my. Okay. He threw an open bag of flour at the face of the cashier or bashed the cashier in the head with a melon.
Ooh, I mean, I'm leaning towards the banana. I wish I wasn't, but I've got an image in my head there, so I can't shake it. I'm going to have to go banana all the way, but banana in his pocket.
Okay, well, guess what? That's right. They have a surveillance camera showing him grabbing the banana right next to the cashier, putting it in his sweatshirt pocket and pointing it at the cashier. And he makes a getaway on his bicycle.
While eating the banana.
I'm sorry?
While eating the banana?
No. Your third question. Here we go, Craig. Your third novel is entitled The Cambridge Diaries, A Tale of Friendship, Love, and Economics. That is...
Catchy. That's a bestseller in the making.
That is the best title ever. Okay.
That's flippin' fantastic.
That's flippin' fantastic. Okay. It closely mirrors your own college days at Cambridge University. Is that right, Craig?
That's true. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
True.
Which of these is not true of Cambridge? So we're sniffing out the bad one again. Which one's not true of Cambridge? Is it A?
There's a wooden bridge at Cambridge, which was designed in such a way that it hangs on gravity without any screws or bolts to support or reinforce the structure. It's called a mathematical bridge, and according to famous myth, it was built by Sir Isaac Newton himself. However, the bridge was designed by William Etheridge and built by James Essex in 1749, before we were a country, Tim.
When we were just colonists. Okay. And, or is it B?
Cambridge University has produced some of the best scholars in the world. Its alumni include legends such as Erasmus, famous scholar, Sir Walter Raleigh, renowned explorer, and William Tyndale, translator of the Bible.
Or is it C?
A frowned-upon activity of the students involves climbing on the college buildings at night. Some of the climbers, not just content with scaling a century-old structures, have used night climbing to commit several inventive pranks. In 2009, students placed some 25 Santa hats on various buildings, including the pinnacle of King's College Chapel and the top of Pembroke Porter's Lodge.
All right, Craig. So one of these is not true of Cambridge. Is it A, the wooden bridge that was supposedly built by Sir Isaac Newton? Is it B, that Cambridge had some famous alumni, including Erasmus, Walter Raleigh, and William Tyndale? Or is it C, that some mischievous students climbed buildings and put Santa hats back in 2009?
Tough one. Now, I've got a bit of local knowledge here. So I think I've walked across the bridge, the mathematical bridge. It's in Queen's College, which was next to my college, St. Catherine. So I'm pretty sure that's true. So I'm going to disregard A. Now, the pranks... I could see that. We got up to a few things, and I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but banana in the pocket is quite related to that, actually. So I could see that being true. So I'm going to say, I'm wondering whether B's the false one. I'm wondering whether those famous people maybe went somewhere else. I don't know. I'm going to say B's false.
Well, guess what, Craig? That is correct. Yes. Those famous people actually are from, are you ready to boo? Are they from Oxford?
I might have known. I might have known you'd go down that line. Disgusting.
Oh, I could listen to you say disgusting all day. That's awesome. There are some very, actually a longer, bigger list of scholars from Cambridge, graduated from there, but those three did not. So Scott, how did Craig do on today's quiz?
Good job, Arthur Barton. You got 3 out of 3 correct. That's 100%. Hey, that's good enough to be a winner.
Woo! Yeah.
Congratulations. You've won absolutely nothing, Craig. But Chris just won a free download of Rockin' the Standards album, the educational rock and roll music for 2nd through 6th graders.
Fantastic.
Great job, Craig. Not many guests get 100%, and we didn't really help you on those. So you really know your books that you wrote, I guess.
I'm the only one who's read them, so that helps.
Oh, okay. I highly doubt that. Well, why don't you tell your new fans here across the pond how they can follow up after our broadcast and learn more about you and learn from you as Scott and I have.
Sure. Well, if anybody's still listening, as I say, don't hate me too much. I'm still trying to learn. But if you want to look me up, then on Twitter, I'm Mr. Barton Maths. And my two websites are MrBartonMaths.com and DiagnosticQuestions.com. And also, as you've kindly pointed out, I host the Mr. Barton Maths podcast. But you'll find all details of that on my Mr. Barton Maths website.
Hey, Craig, real quick question about your podcast. If you were to say, start with this episode, if somebody's new, which episode would you say?
Great question. I think I would say the Dylan William one. That has really kind of transformed the way he talks about assessment, planning, the way he kind of takes apart some misconceptions. Like that one I've listened to so many times, and every time I learn something new. So the Dylan William episode, definitely.
Yes,
fantastic.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. We look forward to having you on again and hopefully meet you in person someday. Maybe we can come visit you in the 5 degrees Celsius weather of northern England.
That'd be great. You're always welcome. And look, it's been an absolute pleasure. I've loved every minute of this, so thanks so much.
So have I. All right. And thanks for watching, everybody. And thanks for watching, most of all,
Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bedley Brothers. Bedley, Bedley Brothers. Bringing education information like no other. Bedley Brothers. Bedley, Bedley Brothers.